Tom Lehrer there with Bat's Mathematics, a rarity that was included on the box set that they put out, I guess already more than 10 years ago. So the guest I have on the program now, Bob Claster, who's in the neighborhood with us, or at least by telephone, or no, I'll correct myself, in the neighborhood with me, since I am the one talking to him, and all of you out there, God bless you, are listening. So he got to talk to Tom Lehrer. Unfortunately, perhaps not his best interview, but I give you credit for posting it on your website to have your mistakes up there as well as your, you know, your shining
moments.
Well,
I'm sure it's not as egregious as I'm fairly self-critical and hard on myself. And so, you know, it probably is something that if I hadn't pointed out, a lot of people wouldn't have noticed, but I don't mind. I don't care. I have no shame.
So who were some of the better interviews at the station? After Tom Lehrer, who else?
That's the only one that I think was that I hear and think I was. I learned that lesson very quickly.
Cool.
You know, I learned this from the first one. Right after that, I did Jonathan and Darlene Edwards. One thing I need to correct: you said that I did these things live and in the studio. In most cases, I was bringing portable recording equipment to wherever these people happened to be. And then I would edit them for broadcast, so they weren't live for the most part. The John Cleese and Michael Palin duo interview,
which is marvelous,
is pretty close to live because they were so good. And in that one, I just sit back and say hello, and then shut up for half an hour, and then that's why it's the best one because they're just so great together. And I highly recommend to anybody who's going to listen to that one, you can hear these things at bobclaster.com. If you're going to listen to that one, try and listen to it in stereo, preferably with headphones, because I was smart enough to pan them in the stereo spectrum, so because there are a lot of moments where they're talking under each other, and the funniest stuff is the stuff that, like, Palin says under his breath when Cleese is going on and becoming slightly too pompous, which he has a tendency to do from time to time, or the little comments that John makes under his breath when Michael is talking. So that's a pretty good one.
And so I just listened to it this week, and it really is quite delightful. And one of the cool things about it is, you know how on every late-night talk show, on every show, the guests go on there, and they talk about some movie that they're doing, and, you know, they play a clip, and they say, how was it to work with this actor, and blah, blah, blah. And you hear Cleese from, 15, 20 years ago, and he's talking about this new movie that he's just been working on. And it's A Fish Called Wanda. And it's kind of neat that this particular time, it's like a minor comedy classic that he's talking about, but not knowing at that point. Just saying, here's my new film. Jamie Lee Curtis is in it. Michael's in it. Blah, 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 you know?
The first interview I did with John was at a hotel. The one with Michael actually was down at the station. And I was a big hero at the station for dragging those guys in that day.
Oh, yeah.
But the first time I met John was for Clockwise, this film that he made. And he was being dragged around by Universal to promote that. And he liked the movie, and he thought it was okay, but he wasn't overly enthusiastic about it. And it's not a movie you can be all that overly enthusiastic about. It's kind of cute, and it's got some moments. But, you know, he was doing his duty and promoting the film. I sat down with him, and I was like interview number 15 of the day. And my first question for him was something along the lines of, what is the difference between the Oxford and the Cambridge sense of humor?
Ooh, nice.
And his eyes lit up, because Python was half Oxford and half Cambridge.
Right,
and that interplay is crucial to understanding who they were and what they were about. And there is a very clearly defined sensibility for the two schools.
It's funny that you should bring that up, because I was just thinking about this the other day, of like how if you ask someone who might be reticent or bored or kind of like, I've got to do this, but you show that you're on a little bit more of their wavelength, it can make all the difference in the world. I'll tell this very quickly, but I remember seeing Lou Reed in the street some, a decade or two ago. And,
A man I share a birthday with.
Oh, really? What's your birthday?
March the 2nd.
March the 2nd. Well, happy in 4 months birthday to you and to Lou. I call him Lou, even though he'd probably hit me if I did. But, you know, you see... Sorry?
It's his name.
It's his name. Well, yeah,
he probably hit you if you called him Shirley.
Well, not 30 years ago, but 20 years ago he might have.
But Lou is a lot closer than Shirley.
Yeah, quite a bit. Or what was the girl character that he was playing in those Transformer years? What was it? His girlfriend was Rachel, but it was a man named Rachel. I have to go back and look up that whole era. But
anyway,
so I saw him and I was like, oh my God, it's Lou Reed. Do I just kind of gape and look the other way, or can I get his autograph? But this was like pre-Laurie Anderson, probably, so it's like all his reputation was negative and stay the hell away, and, you know, he'll just bite your head off. So, me being me, I'm like, no, I can't pass up this opportunity. And I go up and say, hi, Mr. Reed, you know. And rather than be like the 10 million people who would say, oh, man, Walk on the Wild Side is so freaking awesome, you know, or you know, Sweet Jane, man, that was like, oh. I was like, well, I love all your work, and I love Berlin, and I hear that you're going to do more work on a project that he was doing with John Cale at the time called Songs for Drella. And, you know, because I was a fan, a real fan, and I was following his career. So I said, you know, are you going to do that at Brooklyn Academy of Music, or what's the deal with that? And again, he went from being this stone-faced, like, who is this a-hole talking to me on the street, to, oh, yeah, no, you know, John and I are still working on that, and we've got a project together. And, you know, thanks, man. And I got his autograph, and I got the hell away. But asking the right question to the right person at the right time, it makes that difference, like it did that first time he got to John Cleese on that day, of saying Oxford versus Cambridge. Was he was the Oxford, right?
Yes.
And
Cleese was Cambridge.
Cleese was Cambridge, and then so...
Oxford ones were Jones and... Terry Jones and Michael Palin both went to Oxford.
Wow.
And I believe Terry Gilliam did as well.
Cool.
But I'm not sure about Terry Gilliam. He may be none of the above, but I think Terry Gilliam went to college in the United States for a while, so...
Right, he was the American, so...
He's the honor. We'll make him the honorary Oxfordian. And the Cambridge boys were Cleese and Chapman and Idle. You have the same dynamic in Beyond the Fringe. You have two Oxford and two Cambridge.
Now, speaking of Beyond the Fringe, it was John Cleese who really did you a solid, a favor, or, well, maybe you don't feel that way, of getting one of your most famous and unusual and reclusive guests for your radio.
Oh, well, no, he did me a wonderful favor, and he was a splendid fellow. And you know, when I did that first interview with him, you know, the one that started with that Oxford Cambridge question, his eyes lit up, and he said to the poor woman who was the publicity person for Universal, who was trying to flog this picture, you know, he said, you know, cancel the rest of my day. I think we're going to be here for a while.
Oh, marvelous.
And when the interview was finished, he said, that was one of the most remarkable interviews I've ever had, and please get a copy to me. So I gave him a copy, and then it started like this pen pal relationship, and we stayed in touch for a number of years. And so, you know, he came to me to promote A Fish Called Wanda rather than me going after him at that point.
Oh, lovely.
And there's a whole long and ultimately very sad story about a TV documentary series that he wanted me to produce for the Pythons that I desperately wanted to do and tried to do, and it broke my heart when it fell apart. And then I ran into Michael Palin years later, and he tried to resuscitate it because he liked the idea too, and it looked like it was going to happen again, and again it didn't, and it breaks my heart that I never got to make that.
I don't understand. I mean, if it's Monty Python, wouldn't there be the money to put together?
Yes, there was the money to do it. The problem is the Pythons, the way things work in Python is none of that money gets spent. No decisions are made on behalf of the group without a unanimous decision.
Oh.
And it's not that it's so hard to get them to agree on anything, it's just so hard to get them all together in the same place at the same time. And that was what held things up for a long time. Plus, there was a woman who was running their company. Terry Jones explained this to me many years later. He said, you know, there's this woman, I won't mention her name, but there's this woman who runs things for us, and she's got a lovely life, and she's married to a barrister, and they have this great house out in the country, and her life is much more pleasant and much less complicated when we're not actually in production. So she does everything that she can to dissuade production and to keep it from happening. And he suggested that she may have been the one to sink this. But it was going to be a 6-part history of that particular wave of British comedy, based on a wonderful, wonderful book called From Fringe to Flying Circus. I believe the book is out of print, but it is well worth hunting for.
I vaguely remember reading it and liking it quite a lot. Yeah,
it's an amazing book, and I had it with me when I did the Cleese and Palin interview, and that was sort of what led to this whole sad project, was I had the book with me, and both Michael and John said, glad you got that book, because of all the books that have been written about us, that's the one that gets everything right.
Wow.
And it was my Bible. And I said, you know, it always occurred to me that this book would make a terrific TV documentary series with clips and interviews. And they said, you know, we've been thinking the same thing. We just haven't been able to find anybody to do it. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, yeah, I'm the guy to do it. And I called John the next day, and I said, you know, I'm the guy to do it. And he thought for a minute, and he said, well, of course you are. Why didn't I think of that? But yes, you absolutely are. So we tried to make it happen. And
it did that. But the one thing that John Cleese, among other things, did for you is he got you one guest that...
Yeah, he helped make it possible for me to interview Peter Cook. At the time was pretty much retired from the world of comedy, and at the time was a fairly serious drunk, you know, I met him in a hotel room in L.A. Mm-hmm. He was just kind of passing through town for one reason or another, and spent a lovely couple hours with Peter Cook.
Now, the interesting thing about, and we were talking about this earlier this week off the air, was that a lot of your interviews, because they were pre-recorded and not done live at the station, you had the chance to get, like, let's say, an hour of material and chop it down and get it into that half hour, or maybe for some of the interviews you had a longer slot. But you know,
I was, you know, my program for most of its life aired within a block of programming that was entertainment rather than information. So it was most of the week during that time slot there were either radio dramas or comedies, or it was a specifically entertainment block. So for me to do a solid half hour of just informational interview, even of someone very funny, I didn't feel really right about doing that. I thought that was sort of not really the thrust of the show, and that the show had to have laughs in it. Even, you know, hearing a brilliant comedian talk seriously about comedy isn't all that funny. It's very interesting, but it's not all that funny. Yeah. So most of these shows have in them interspersed clips of these people's work as it comes up in the conversation. So that was the main excuse for editing them. But once you... I love post-production, and I love making a silk purse out of a sow's ear, you know, it's fun to tighten things up and make them better if you have a deft hand with that, and if you're able to do it invisibly.
But I bring that up specifically because, as you said in, say, the Cleese Palin interview, you just let him roll. But in the Peter Cook interview, it was very different, even though he wasn't drunk. Or, well, he was probably pleasantly sozzled.
I don't even think he was. He nursed a champagne cocktail over a couple hours while we were talking. He was just kind of old and you know, he spoke very slowly, but very. He was still great. He was still funny, and he was still Peter Cook.
But you mentioned that
brilliant mind and one of the funniest people who ever lived. You know, a sad guy in a way. I mean, he said. One of the things he says to me in the interview, he said, I knew that I had done my best work by the time, when I was an undergraduate. and that I would never be that good again.
Which was not necessarily true, quite honestly, for people who love Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
I think it is true.
Really?
I think it is true, yeah. It was as an undergraduate that he wrote the Tarzan sketch, and he wrote a lot of the great sketches from Beyond the Fringe and some of the things that Kenneth Williams did that were so funny. And he wrote a lot of the stuff that he later went on to do with Dudley Moore. He wrote the Tarzan sketch. I asked him how long it took him to... You know the piece I'm talking about. Your listeners may not. It's a classic piece of comedy writing about a one-legged man going to a casting agent auditioning for the role of Tarzan.
Your right leg is lovely. I have nothing against your right leg. Unfortunately, neither do you.
Exactly.
I'll never forget that line as long as I live. Yeah.
Its trouble is neither of you, though. If you're going to quote it correctly.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, but you're right.
At any rate, I asked him how long he works on that, because if you really sit down and look at the script, every line is perfect. It's just a little polished gem of a piece of comedy material. He said it took me as long as it would take you to type it. He said, I had the idea, sat down at the typewriter, wrote it, and 5 minutes later I was on my way to dinner, And that was... He was famous for that. He would just, get an idea and dash it off. And these are things that comedy writers look at and go, oh, my God, you must have polished that and edited it and honed it. And no, he just kind of typed it out. But those sort of things sort of stopped coming to him after a while. But he enjoyed his life.
For
the most part.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Had a fun life and had a lot of friends and... got involved in a magazine and/newspaper, a satirical newspaper called Private Eye. That was I believe he owned a majority share in Private Eye in London. And Private Eye is, especially during the years that he was there, almost exclusively concerned with local politicians who are incomprehensible to foreigners, and so. I've seen a lot of copies of Private Eye that I just don't get. I'm sure there's a lot of funny there, but it's jokes about people I don't know.
So. Let me ask. Speaking of the people that Bob Claster has had on his radio program at KCRW, the one that really just made my eyes bug out because I almost if I tried a little harder could have gotten an interview for my own. Show, or at least it may have been a little before Dave's Gone By started, so I would have done it just as a freelance writer more than anything else, but to interview Brother Theodore, one of the great...
Well, you certainly could have interviewed Brother Theodore. I mean, he was in the damn phone book, and waiting for you to call him.
He wasn't... You have to admit...
That's true of most of the interviews that I did. These are people who had become somewhat forgotten... And were eager to tell their story. I did that same weekend. I was visiting my family in New York, and I had some connection with Brother Theodore in the past. I grew up loving that first record of his, and some friends and I had this student coffee house in New Rochelle, and we weren't paying anybody. And at one point, I went down to see Brother Theodore perform in New York, where he. Performed every, I think, Saturday night at midnight, and he was great, and I asked him if he would come and play at our coffee house, and we couldn't pay him, but we'd love to have him, and he said, sure, I'd be happy to.
Oh.
He said, my only problem is I want to make sure that there are no young children there who might be frightened, and that was his only concern, and he came on He took the train out to New Rochelle and did the show, and he was great. So I knew he was a lovely guy. And it just occurred to me somebody should interview him. I was going to be in New York. And similarly, I called Quentin Crisp, whom I loved. So I did them back-to-back one night, just on two successive nights. And very interesting, two brilliant older men.
With an extraordinary gift for language, both of them, under the way the phraseology of both of those people was amazing.
Yes, absolutely, and that's something that I am drawn to. So that's I had a lot of fun with both of those, and they're both certainly Chris more so than Theodore, but they're both slightly marginal to the world of comedy. But at that point, my show had been on the air for a number of years, and I had a following, and my attitude was, I'll do what I want to do.
Thank goodness you did.
I was in an enviable position at this station because the station was becoming hugely popular, and yet the people who oversaw programming, none of them thought that I fit under their particular wing. So we had a program. We had the program director / station manager was a woman, a brilliant woman, but one with no sense of humor or affinity for comedy whatsoever, and so she totally ignored the program. And the other person was the music director, and there was only occasional music in my show, so he didn't think of me as under his department. So I was almost completely left alone.
Isn't that the great conundrum of broadcasting? You want everybody to hear and love your show, and yet if you can operate under the radar, that is also kind of cool too. But thank goodness you have the archives.
Frustrating things about any sort of creative art, especially anything that's remotely commercial, is, there are so many stories and so many instances of creative people who know best, who are not permitted to do what it is they're good at because somebody who has a job that entitles them to tell the creative person what to do gets in and mucks it up rather than just leaving them alone. I love things like, for instance, this season on FX, Louis C.K. had a show.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw it, but and it may be still rerunning. If it is, you need to see it immediately and rent it when it comes out on DVD or buy it or something. And what's wonderful about the show, first of all, I think that Louis C.K. is possibly the very best stand-up currently working. Saw him live a couple weeks ago and just totally blew me away. He was just amazing. But he did this show for FX, and his deal with FX was, I'm not going to tell you in advance what the stories are. I'm not even going to give you titles. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go out and make these shows, and then I'm going to deliver them to you, and you have one and one choice to make, and that is, do you put it on the air or do you not?
Wow.
So he's not getting notes from network suits. He's not getting interference. He's going out, and he's making the show that he wants to make, and he writes them all, he directs them all, and he edits them all. And I love that. I think that's there are a lot of guys who could do that. There's not a lot of guys you should trust with that kind of responsibility.
But it's lovely
when it happens. Yeah. I've worked in television enough to know that the more money you get involved, the more people there are who have jobs where it's, in order to justify the huge amount of money these people are making, they feel they have to make some kind of input and make some kind of change, and they don't know what the hell they're talking about, and they just make stupid interferences that ruin things. So it's always nice when somebody gets to just actually, knows what he's doing, does it.
That's the same principle as, say, that Larry David could create Curb Your Enthusiasm, but he would be in a position to say, okay, I've made gazillion dollars doing Seinfeld, and I've made you gazillions of dollars doing Seinfeld. Therefore, give me a camera, I'll do the scripts and the improv, I'll get it together, and I will deliver what I really want to deliver to you. I'm not pleasing anybody but me. And that is pretty great.
Now, the downside for Louis C.K. is that, he's working for FX for, $1.98 a show, and
I'd work for $1.97.
FX. Well, I think he was offered a lot more money by HBO and by some other people, but they weren't prepared to give him the kind of autonomy that he wanted. Mm. And that series of his was brilliant. It was just wonderful. Not for kids.
Okay.
I stress this. It's not. it's maybe the most adult thing I've ever seen on television.
Good Lord.
Okay.
I mean, are we talking about violence and sex, or are we just talking about stuff that's so beyond the realm of a child that, how do you mean?
Certainly sex.
Oh, good. Okay.
not a lot of violence. But just very adult themes. And
I have to check this out. What is the name of the show?
Louie. L-O-U-I-S.
L-O-U. I will be checking it out. And I want to thank...
Bob, if you're not familiar with Louie, mm-hmm. the best introduction to his comedy, what he does that's so brilliant and that I have so much respect for, is once a year he throws out his entire act. And for a stand-up, you know, pieces of material at work are like gold, and they save them and protect them. But he knows he does enough television, and the stuff gets burned up. And he had a successful HBO special, and he says, I think it was Chris Rock who gave him the advice, and he said, look, now you're going on a tour to promote this special. All these people saw this special, and they loved it. Some of them even know it by heart. He said, if you go out there and you do that special, everybody's going to have a great time. They're all going to come out and see it, and your career will be over because they will feel like they have seen you do what you do, and it's done. They will not come back to see you a second time because they'll say, well, we saw him. So what you need to do is throw it all out and start all over again. You'll come out with totally new material. The people who love you will be pleasantly delighted, and they'll think that the new material is as good as the old material, and they'll come back next year to see what you got then. And that's what he does. He throws out his material every year, and then he goes out on the road and does a tour of the country. By the end of the tour, he's ready to put that stuff on video, and he'll do either a special or a movie or something. And then he throws it all out and starts all over again every year. And each year's routine, each year's act, has been progressively better and progressively deeper and more personal and more meaningful in addition to being funnier. I mean, he's just hilarious. And so his 2009 routine was filmed and is going to be released in like 3 or 4 weeks, January something.
Well let me ask you, Bob, first of all, I need to do a station ID here. It's 12:02 in the afternoon here in the University of Northern Colorado. It's also 12:02 a lot of other places in this whole time zone. On December 18th, 2010, I want to welcome all our listeners to Dave's Gone By. We've been on since 10 o'clock, and we'll be here till 1, or possibly a little longer, because we're talking so much good stuff with Bob Claster, and I do also want to play some more Captain Beefheart towards the end of the show to celebrate his life and recall his passing yesterday. But we are talking with radio broadcaster and TV person Bob Claster, and he's discussing, well, we got onto the topic of Louis C.K., which makes me ask, do you miss having the radio program where you would try and call up and try and interview people?
Yeah,
like
that's about the only time I've missed doing it. By the end of it, I mean, most of the shows were just playing comedy records or recorded comedy of some kind. I tried to, again, keep the show in the entertainment rather than information slot, and so I tried not to do more than one interview per month. Sometimes things just happened and people fell in my lap and I was able to do more, and I think there might have been a couple months that had more than one interview in them, but I tried to just do one interview per month. But most of the time, there was this, I had done everybody twice after about 8 years at least, and I got through about the first 5 years of the show without ever rerunning anything, except for I think some of the interview shows. But I never reran a comedy show. And then I had to. I ran out of ideas. So see, the problem is the comedy record had as an art form had a very brief moment in the sun, and it existed for a very particular reason and served a very particular need that was no longer in existence after the mid-70s. So there aren't a lot of great comedy albums really post Saturday Night Live, and I think Saturday Night Live is the key reason why there aren't. The comedy records were very necessary through the 50s and 60s because you had a segment of the population that was underserved by mass media. You had a hip, educated segment of the audience who were too hip for prime time. Who, you know, the Carol Burnett show was about the hippest thing on television, right. And that wasn't all that hip. And, you know, television started out with hip comedy with Sid Caesar, but...
Well, also Milton Berle, which was not so hip, but yeah.
Pardon me?
Well, and also Milton Berle, right, the anti-hip.
But there was hip comedy when television first started, because the first people who had television sets were... educated and fairly wealthy and were first adopters and you know, cutting edge people.
Sure.
As more and more of, and so Sid Caesar could come on the air and do parodies of psychoanalysis in Japanese movies. But as more and more of the middle class and the lower classes got television, mm-hmm. the audience share for comedy like Caesar's, became too small to be worth competing for, and Sid Caesar was thrown off the air because of Lawrence Welk, who was on opposite him and was getting much better ratings. So once that shift happened, once television started courting the lowest common denominator because it became so huge, there wasn't much hip comedy on television. So you had hip people who, you know, who wanted something a little edgier than Andy of Mayberry,
right.
And so you know, they sort of clutched to their bosom the Lenny Bruce records and the Bob Newhart records and the Nichols and May records and these things, and they passed them around from friend to friend. And people had parties and played this. The, you know,
yes.
The latest Nichols.
Not to Nichols mention the party records of Red Fox.
Can you believe they're talking to us? You know,
yeah.
This is smart stuff. This is way smarter than what we're getting on television. So you have this underserved group of people who were getting their fix from these comedy records. It was possible to do that at that point. Then Saturday Night Live came on in, what, 74, 75, something like that.
75, yeah.
And right around that time in this country, we started seeing, even though it had already been in existence, we started seeing Monty Python. And so that underserved group started to get served. I remember vividly the sense of, it was just this glorious feeling when Saturday Night Live came on. Oh my God, they're talking to me.
Right.
You know, they're actually, you know, they're putting on bands I like, and they're not lip syncing, and they're doing drug jokes, and they're doing political jokes, and you know, it was, and so that pretty much signaled an end to the comedy record. You didn't need, you know, when you had the, you know, stand-up specials on 24 hours a day on cable
It took a few years to die. I mean, there was still the George Carlin stuff and the Richard Pryor. I mean, that went well into the early 80s, and Robin Williams was doing recording material. I mean, it took, for a while, it was a symbiotic feed. And then you had, of course, the growth of cable television, too. So Carlin could go on HBO and do his thing, and people would really be served there. So I think it wasn't until sort of the mid-80s that it really kind of tailed off. It wasn't like this immediate thing in the 70s, at least in my opinion.
At any rate, there aren't a lot of new comedy records that I'd love to play on the radio, that I wish I could play on the radio. I mean, look, Lewis puts out an album, and you know, Maria Bamford has a very funny album that I just listened to a little bit. I love her. And there are comics who are putting out CDs, but...
Well, you've got Dane Cook, and you've got... The redneck
Pardon?
Guy. You've got Dane Cook and the redneck fellow. What's his name? Larry the Cable Guy. I mean, they do. You know, but it's not the same.
Yeah, I don't know that I'd give Larry the Cable Guy any more airtime than he already has. But you know, that's just me. But at any rate, I don't miss doing that. I do miss the interviews. The interviews were fun, and I think I was really good at them. One of my favorite shows on television was Bob Costas's Later, the show that he did after Letterman on NBC for a number of years, in which it was just a one-on-one interview, and he asked all the right questions, and they had fabulous research coming up with incredible clips, and they got great people, and it was just also, I happen to know from talking to people on the show, that was also a very edited show. It was edited so well that no one ever realized that. But
well, I wouldn't be surprised if it was also. I wouldn't be surprised if it's also the same with the fellow on public television who does the one-on-one interviews.
Charlie Rose.
I'm sure he does say 40 minutes per person that is then chopped to about 26. I wouldn't be surprised.
I don't know. I'd be interested to find out. I don't know, but I know that was sort of what Costas used to do.
Mm-hmm.
Is he would get someone like Shelley Fabre to come on, and she would want to talk about Major Dad, which was her current show.
Yeah.
And he would talk with her for half an hour about Major Dad, and he would say, "As long as you're here, let's have some Donna Reed stories."
Of course.
Because that's what everybody wanted to hear.
Right.
So he'd get the Donna Reed stories, and that would be all he'd go on the air with.
Ooh.
And he would just throw out all the Major Dad stuff that nobody cared about.
That's brave. Because you don't get a guest back after that, but good for him, you know?
But no, but he did get them back because they were great shows and people loved them. And you know, I'm sure the publicists hated him, but I don't think the talent hated him.
Hmm.
But I could be wrong about that. I don't know.
Now, speaking of talents, you were using your talents. I mean, as you said, you were at KCR working there, not just doing a show, but paying for other things. But your main bread and butter for a long while has not been radio at all. It's been television. So,
yeah, I was, you know, I was doing funny stuff, and I was keeping my oar in the water at KCRW, hoping that a real job would pop up, that I would be offered. And, in fact, finally a real job did pop up, and I was offered it, and it was for less money than I could afford to live on. And it was, understandably, KCRW's license is held by Santa Monica College, and it's something that they do for neighborhood brownie points and no other reason. And they feel, rightfully so, I would imagine, that, or at least at the time this was their feeling, things may have changed, but they felt, why should we be paying these people who work for our radio station more than we're paying the teachers who are doing the business of the university? So we were getting paid a lot less than most radio people get. We were getting paid teacher salaries and less. And so the job was, at that time, I had gotten married and I had two kids, and I talked it over with my wife and realized I couldn't afford to take this job that I had been trying to get. And by that time, the bloom was off the rose. KCRW was changing and was becoming a station I didn't like as well. And I got to know the people well enough to know that I didn't think I would really fit in there and be happy there as much as I had thought that I would. So so I didn't take that job. And a friend of mine worked in television and was... got me a job as a researcher on a game show. She said, you ought to work in television. There's much more money there. And so I worked as a researcher on a game show. And then
Which one?
Oh, it was one of the worst jobs of my life. It was the last remake of The Joker's Wild.
Oh, my God. The Joker's Wild. With Jack Barry, right?
No, this was after Jack Barry. I can't remember the host's name. I've blanked out a lot of this job because it was so brutal and miserable.
Why was it so awful?
Pardon me?
Why was it so awful?
All right, well, the game was structured in such a way that the contestant was required to identify a noun. So you are told Valhalla, and the judge has written on the card in front of him, Valhalla. It's where the Norse gods went to die. And the contestant says, oh, yes, Valhalla, that's a town in upstate New York. And the judge says, no, according to my card here, it's where the Norse gods went to die. And the contestant goes, no, I went to that high school. It's a high school in a town in upstate New York. And you have to stop tape, and the researchers have to run and look and see, is it really a town in upstate New York, too?
Well, I'm sure you get that on Jeopardy also. I mean, that's a par for the course in a trivia game, isn't it?
Well, no, but basically there were so many possible correct answers that could not be predicted. So, for instance, the coat of many colors, and there were the judge has on his card, you know, it's from the Bible, it's Joseph, and blah, blah, blah. And the contestant says, it's a Dolly Parton song.
Oh.
And well, none of us, you know, and it turns out, yes, it is a Dolly Parton song. But you have to stop tape, and you have to call the Country Music Hall of Fame, or you have to call Dolly Parton's record company, or something. And these were, this was pre-internet.
Pre-internet, so we couldn't, yeah, of course. Oh, gosh.
Today, that job of researcher would probably be a lot easier, because you could just put the first 10 Google hits up there, and you'd be fine. But we didn't. We spent a lot of time in libraries, and it was brutal for a lot of reasons having to do with the personalities of the people that we worked for. On a good day, we got out of there at midnight. On bad days, we worked straight through the night into the next day.
Wow.
And I was eventually fired from that job for a typo that I made at 5:30 in the morning on one such night. So it was, you know, people don't you don't realize, you watch your TV shows, you don't realize, like, there's somebody whose job it is to watch all those America's Funniest Home Videos that come in, like, all day, every day. That's their whole job.
Well, I imagine there's an army of people for that show, the amount of video that they would get.
And it's those things are just, that's a horrible way to make a living. It's just terrible. And besides which, there is this attitude in television that I find so appalling, which is that people with jobs in television are just abused horrendously. And I'm not speaking from so much personal experience as much as just things I've witnessed, with the attitude being, look, we're going to push you around all we want to, because if you won't take it, there's a line halfway around the block of people who will. So,
And you generally, you're being paid well, so therefore, you know, you're my bitch.
But you're not being paid well for jobs like that. The people who are being paid well are the producers and the writers and you know, the people who are protected by unions and the people who own the show. Those are the ones who are making the real money. You, who are watching these America's Funniest Home Videos, are getting paid crap, because they don't have to pay you well, because, once again, there's that line going halfway around the block of people who will take that job.
Well, what happened? What did you do after you got that third version of The Joker's Wild and got canned for your title?
Yeah, I gradually segued into writing television. I wrote some specials for ABC on television trivia. I wrote on a show for NBC called Memories Then and Now, which was a really fun show to work on. I had a great time on that job. That job actually gave me the best perk I have ever had in a job. That show actually flew me to Amsterdam to spend a weekend with Xaviera Hollander, the happy hooker.
And yeah. Was she still...
You know, there may be better perks on some jobs. I don't know. That was
right, now hold on, Bob. Now, she had written the book, so she was no longer a practicing woman of the
right.
evening. So, but what did you do with Xaviera Hollander for a weekend, or dare I ask?
Well, Xaviera's a really fascinating lady. She's a great gal.
Okay.
She,
You make her sound like something out of Donna Reed. Oh, yeah, spunky woman. Yeah, okay.
No, she's a character. She went on for many years to write a column for Bob Guccione's Penthouse.
Okay. I shouldn't admit to knowing that, but I knew that. Yeah, okay.
Pardon me?
I should not admit to knowing that, but I knew that. Okay, so...
Yeah, she had this column for decades. And the secret to that column that she told me was that after a couple years... She would answer mail and answer questions.
Right.
And after a couple years of actually reading the letters that people sent in and wrote, she was so appalled at how stupid they were that she asked that they not be sent to her, and she just made them up.
Oh, okay. Well, that's...
And she said the real questions were too stupid.
But what were you following her? In other words, she was a writer at that point.
Well, my department on the show, this was a show that aired, it was called Memories Then and Now. And it was a show that was put together by a company that probably no longer exists that was called NBC News Productions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was designed, because NBC has this huge archive of footage from their history, NBC News does, and it's all out in Fort Lee, New Jersey, in temperature-controlled vaults. And they thought, well, maybe we can exploit some of this footage and do this sort of nostalgia show, a look back at certain things. At various different things, and we got all this footage we don't have to pay for. Well, that's fine, except you can't do stories without using footage that you do have to pay for that NBC doesn't own. So basically, each show there would be a theme, And within each show, there was a department, where are they now?
Okay.
If that was my 3.5 minutes of television a week.
Well, that does sound like fun, yeah.
It was fun. And so, you know, each week I would, you know, I would talk to Gary Lewis on the phone and do a piece about him. And then the next week it would be Bobby Sherman. And then the next week it would be Sasheen Littlefeather, you know, whatever it became of.
Yeah, right.
Whatever it became of. And where are they now? And
so Sasheen Littlefeather.
So I did a piece of Where Are They Now? WRO. I spent an entire day on the phone with Pete Best. For that show.
Where was he then when you talked to him?
It was a great story. I don't know if he's still doing it, but Pete Best, the man most famous for having lost a job at the time that I spoke to him, was working for the unemployment department in Liverpool helping other people find jobs.
Well, that is nice.
Which I thought there was just a real wonderful, there's poetry in that.
Yeah, but when...
You know, that's it.
At this point, though, as wonderful as that is, and bless him for doing that, wouldn't you figure he would be famous enough to do, like, a one-man lecture show? He could tour around everywhere?
Well, he kind of is. He's got a band, or at least he did back then. He had a band, and nobody really cared. And,
well, yeah, well, you know.
You know, I mean, it's a sad... The Pete Best story is certainly a sad one. I mean, it's sad in a lot of ways. He, the parts that I found terrible about that story are the fact that the Beatles go in the studio to record their first record, Love Me Do, and George Martin is the fledgling young producer, and Martin says, just like offhand to Brian Epstein, you know, the drummer's not very good, but that's okay, I'll bring in a studio drummer, and it'll be fine. And the studio drummer's name was Andy White.
Oh, yeah.
Trivia fans, and so there is this version of Love Me Do, which came out and has a non-Beatle drummer on it.
Right,
well,
I think that's even on the Rarities collection, yeah.
Brian Epstein being very eager to please and very happy to have his new EMI recording contract, says, I'll go you one better, I'll fire the drummer. And the boys don't like him all that much anyway. And it's true. Lennon and Harrison and McCartney didn't really bond with Pete all that well. He was not really one of the gang, and they didn't share this unique Beatles sense of humor with him all that much. And, you know, he was okay. They didn't think he was a terrible drummer, but they didn't think he was a great drummer. He basically was their drummer because his mother owned this club that they could play in. And
he also was a good-looking fellow, so he was sort of one of the girl magnets.
Yeah. He was good-looking and had girls screaming for him, and he so they took him on, but then so Brian Epstein said, you know, I'll go you one better, and I'll actually fire his ass. So Epstein went to talk to Pete Best and said, look, Pete, thanks for the memories, but you know, you're toast, and. But from that moment on, Pete never heard from any of the actual Beatles.
Oh.
Nobody called him and said, yeah, sorry, it's, you know, too bad, that's the way it goes. And when they became famous and wealthy, very shortly thereafter, they never sent him a little thank you note or tossed him a million or two here or there to just, you know, for the part that he played in helping them get off the ground.
It's business.
It's a fascinating. Yeah. I mean, I downloaded it illegally because it's not available commercially, but you can download this fascinating document, which is the complete Beatles radio appearances on the BBC. And you get to hear them through 62 and 63 as they're getting ready to take over the world.
Actually, I don't think it's all that illegal. I think they did release a CD called The Beatles at the Beeb a few years ago.
And that doesn't do it.
Yeah.
That, I don't recommend that because that is, that's all, first of all, it's heavily edited and it's chopped up and it's not chronological. What I'm talking about is if you listen to these things chronologically,
uh-huh.
from week to week, you hear them come together as a band. You hear Lennon
wow.
become a singer as opposed to just a guy with a good voice who's singing. You hear them gel, and it's a fascinating progression. It's, you know, they were on the radio almost every week in England, and in those days, you had to, pop music was not allowed to be broadcast on the BBC during most periods of the day. The BBC had different times of the day for different things, and pop music was only heard, say, Saturday afternoons for 2 hours. And so every kid in England was listening.
Right.
And so the Beatles' opportunity to be on the radio so much during those years was huge in helping them take over that country in preparation for taking over the world. And you hear them develop this poise and develop the, I mean, as you listen to it from week to week, and they will sometimes do the same song, you know, 6 weeks in a row. So you hear a lot of, I mean, the only song they let Ringo sing was Boys. So you hear Boys a lot when you listen to these shows chronologically. But, and you hear from week to week, Harrison just struggling with the guitar part to Please Please Me. It takes him like about 2 months to get the hang of it, finally gets it by the end of it, you know. But you can just hear them struggling with these things, but you hear them coming together. And again, you hear the poise develop. At first, you know, the early ones, the 62, you hear the announcer say, well, there's this band from Liverpool, we kind of like them, and we think of like them. Please give a warm welcome to these, what's the name here? Yeah, oh, the Beatles.
Yeah, yeah.
But by the end of it, it's like, oh my God, we are so honored to have the Beatles here and for taking time out from their busy schedule because they're just like gods, you know?
Well, what's funny for Americans is that, you know, it sprang on, I mean, I wasn't even alive yet, really, but it, we didn't really get that sense of the build that they had in the UK for 2 or 3 years, not to mention, obviously, in Germany, the Cavern Club and all that. But that sense of growing on the radio and all the kids knowing them and listening to them, for American eyes, it was just about, wow, suddenly they're walking off this plane, and people are going crazy, and they have a single out, and they're on Ed Sullivan, and that was it. We never got that ramping up.
But they spent a lot of time getting ready for it, and if you can find this download, I hate to promote illegal downloads, but it's Purple Chick is the person who put it together. That's a bootlegger who does compilation things that are quite wonderful. And so just look for the Purple Chick Complete Beatles BBC stuff. And, if you were to burn it to CD, it would be 20 or 30 CDs. I mean, it really is. It's many, many hours of shows. But if you're as much of a Beatles fan as I am, I found it just fascinating to witness the progression and to hear them get ready. And then, you know, by the end of 63, it's like, well, you're going to America, huh? And they go, yeah, we're going to America. We don't know what we're going to find there. And you know what they're going to find there. It's thrilling. It's just thrilling because you hear them getting ready, and they think they're ready, and they are ready. And it's just so wonderful.
Now, I, unfortunately, you know, it's almost 12:30 here at University of Northern Colorado Radio, uncradio.com. You're listening to Dave's Gone By. Also, for more information about this program, davesgoneby.com. We're talking with Bob Claster, and unfortunately, we have only a couple of minutes left because I want to get back and play a little more Captain Beefheart.
You can mention bobclaster.com, where you can hear all these wonderful old radio shows.
Right, Bob Claster, all those interviews, people like Stan Freberg, Tom Lehrer, the Monty Python crew.
And Van Dyke Parks, which is not comedy, but if you're a Beefheart fan, you may be a Van Dyke Parks fan. And well, Van Dyke is an amazing man, and I had a chance to talk to him. He's still a friend of mine. He's a great guy.
Oh, is he? Did he? I always wonder, is he normal? Does he give a normal interview, or is he sort of out there?
Van Dyke Parks is one of the loveliest people in the world. He is. He has a southern graciousness about him. He's kind and thoughtful and brilliant. And no, he's a lovely, lovely, very special, and very gifted man, and brilliant and funny.
In your travels in music, because we really didn't have enough time to talk about all your television experiences, which is why early in the new year I'm instantly and automatically inviting you back to the neighborhood, if you would be gracious.
Yeah, because all these Bob Claster fans are going to be clamoring for more.
A cluster of Clasterians. That's
what
okay.
You have not yet stumbled upon the one pun I like on my name, but well, if I don't tell you, you'll try, and that'll be terrible.
Well, wait, well, let's see. Well, first of all, this episode, I think, is a Claster piece. Is that the one? No?
No.
Is it an F-word that I can't use on here?
Nope. Perfectly clean.
Oh, perfectly clean. Okay. The name of this episode is Class, not Claster Class, is it?
No. It's like Master Claster.
Master Claster. That's, yeah. No, that's not it either, huh?
I always told my kids growing up, you should never make a joke on people's names because you're just hearing the name for the first time, but they've had it for their whole lives, and they've heard every single joke you can imagine made about it, and no matter what joke you make on somebody's name, they're just going to groan when you say it.
Well, okay. So, well, what, which one did I miss?
Good advice, I think. But, no, the one pun I liked on my name was Iconoclaster.
Oh! That is good. Iconoclaster.
That was the only one that, that I liked.
I like it. Because you're iconic for the interviews that you've done and for the work that you've done. And, again, next time we'll definitely get more into the whole television stuff. But I want to ask, in your travels in the music field, did you ever cross paths with Zappa or Beefheart, who are very much in our minds at this time?
No. I did. There was a period of time where Zappa and the fledgling Mothers performed in a tiny theater in New York on a weekly basis. It was like either every Friday night or every Saturday night. I think it... I don't even remember the name of the theater.
It wasn't Max's Kansas City or anything like that, right? It wasn't Max's.
Pardon me?
It wasn't Max's, right?
No.
No.
No, this was a theater. And it looks sort of like... You know, I mean, it's this really seedy, almost like a porn theater. I mean, it, as I recall, the room... It was a very long and narrow room, so but it was definitely like a movie theater, and so the stage might have only been about 15 to 20 feet wide, and there were about 30 rows, each of which had maybe 10 seats across.
Wow!
And if it was that big at all, and Zappa and the Mothers performed there every week for a while. And I had some friends who would go down and watch them. I think this was right, maybe like in between Freak Out and Absolutely Free.
Wow.
And so I went down to see them a number of times.
Oh, you did go to see them. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I didn't. So, you know, I was a fan. I enjoyed them. I sort of lost interest in Zappa at about the time of, I guess, maybe Burnt Weenie Sandwich or... Something like that. I kind of had enough, but
in those early days with the Mothers, you recognized that there was something amazing going on.
Yeah, and I loved the Reuben and the Jets album, and I loved Absolutely Free, and We're Only In It for the Money, and I think Lumpy Gravy started to get a little weird for me.
Well, and that sure. And Uncle Meat, and all the real strangeness began. But that is so good. Do you have any particular memories? I mean, I know you said you went to see them a couple
of Captain Beefheart?
Or of Zappa, even, because Zappa would have been, I forgot to mention this.
You got to realize, first of all, I was a teenager, and I saw a lot of great concerts. I mean, it was a fabulous time to be in high school in New York. The Fillmore East top price was $5.50, and you never had problems getting tickets. So, you know, I saw The Who do Tommy the night it was released. I saw... you know, the Allman Brothers with Duane Allman. I saw there was a double bill that didn't quite happen, but it was Cream and Moby Grape on the same bill. Didn't show up.
Oh,
but you know, I saw I was at Woodstock. I was at the Bangladesh concert. So I got to see a lot of music and stuff. So, but memories of Zappa? No.
Okay.
I hate to admit it, I was not a Beefheart fan, and I was trying to think about that while I was waiting for you to call, and I was listening to you. And I realized that a lot of my musical taste, and a lot of the reason why there are certain artists that I don't much care for, had less to do with the music itself as much as it had to do with the kind of people who liked them. I was never a David Bowie fan because I didn't like your average David Bowie fan.
Okay.
And all the people who were going on and on about David Bowie were the sort of people I didn't care for. And I think the same is true for Beefheart. The people who were the crazy Beefheart fans were like really pretentious and sort of obnoxious and had this sort of superior attitude. Well, we like this music. We're better than you are, because you know. And I just I didn't respond to them as people, and so I wasn't all that interested in listening to their hero.
Well, you know,
I think some of the musical biases that I have, I now have to reevaluate and realize that the music itself may very well have been valid, and that the only thing that I didn't like was the personality of their fan base.
Well, I was actually, I do believe, if I go back and listen to last week's show, I was talking about this in reference to Led Zeppelin, where I was in high school and junior high school, and kids were just constantly playing it, and the kids who were playing were the bullies. You know, and the greasers and like these people I was terribly afraid of who were often making my life miserable. And so, you know, that's just loud, lousy rock music. I'd rather listen to folk. I'd rather listen to, like, intelligent lyrics and stuff like that and what the cool people...
Think Squeeze My Lemon and Let the Juice Run Down My Leg is an intelligent lyric?
And, well, when you're 14, you know, you don't even get it. Yeah. And plus, that would have been a Robert Johnson thing.
I was a Led Zeppelin fan for a very similar reason. I remember the people who were the Led Zeppelin fans, and I didn't much like them. I still am not a Led Zeppelin fan. I think the music is just, you know, it's all bombast and
yeah, but some of it is tremendous. Some of it is great. I mean, it took me until my 20s, I guess.
It's all hair, Dave. It's all about hair. Led Zeppelin is all about Robert Plant's hair, and that's about all.
Okay, well, he did have good hair at one point. You know, he probably still has the hair. That's why I envy him.
Yes.
It looks like a mop, yeah, but no, he still has it. You know.
No, I was never a Led Zeppelin fan, but you know, I like a lot of blues music, and so do they, obviously. But
right.
You know.
Anyway, we have been talking with Bob Claster, so I'm going to remind everybody again to go to bobclaster.com to find out more about him and to hear archives of all these interviews that he's done. I didn't even get to ask you about Steve Allen, the whole Stan Freberg thing. We're going to do this early in the new year. We're going to bring you back. We're going to talk so much more about that, so much more about your years doing teleprompter stuff. All on TV game shows and the Jerry Lewis telethon. And, I mean, just so much to your life. And we haven't even scratched the surface. We've scratched an inch of air above the surface of Bob Claster. But it's been delightful. It's been absolutely just so much fun to have a real conversation with someone who's been toiling in the broadcasting mines for all these years, Bob.
You're easily amused, Dave.
Well, I hope our listeners have been, too. And I would continue right to the top of the hour.
Both of them.
I want to do more Beefheart. Sorry?
I said both of them.
Oh, yeah.
Don't worry about it.
I know. Anyway, so what? Last question for Bob. What project are you working on now? Is it musical stuff? Because
I still work in television every now and then. I teleprompted for P. Diddy on the on the Jimmy Kimmel show a couple of nights ago.
Okay.
And it was very funny because I went from working with P. Diddy to a little hotel where a friend of mine sings in a band that does 20s and 30s Depression era music. And so I went from P. Diddy hip hop to Depression era music and got a little whiplash.
Okay. Well, actually, Kanye West would appreciate that more than P. Diddy.
Making that transition. But, I still work a ton. We're coming up on the award show season, and I'll work on a lot of the big award shows. I usually do the prompting on the half hour that airs before the Oscars, the red carpet show that's hosted by Billy Bush or whoever. So I'm usually working on that show during the Oscars, but do just about all the big award shows, the SAG Awards and the People's Choice and the all these big award shows. This year, things have been a little sparse. I used to always have a regular running talk show, which put bread on the table on a nice regular basis. Things like I did Mind of Mencia and I did Spike Ferriston's show on Fox. And, you know, I like having a regular show, especially a union one.
Oh, yeah.
It pays my benefits. But, but I currently don't have one, so I'm not doing that. I would sometimes work on Real Time with Bill Maher.
Oh, cool.
Which is a live show, and I like it because of that. And it's a smart show for smart people.
And remind everybody, well, not remind, they don't know this, but the weirdest, coolest thing, and then we really do have to let you go, but one thing that they don't know about Real Time with Bill Maher is that, da-da-da-da-da, you told me this earlier in the week. Where is it taped?
It's taped at CBS.
Well, yeah, we know. Sure. Well, it's actually an HBO show.
I know what you're getting at. I'm just busting it up.
Okay.
No, the stage that Real Time with Bill Maher is taped on, not taped, it's a live show. The show that it's broadcast from on Fridays is on Monday through Thursday, the site of The Price is Right.
So they take all this Price is Right stuff, the flashing, the Vegas-y things. Do they push it to the side, or they just cover it up, or what the hell do they do?
They just move it somewhere. They stick it out in the hallway. I mean, you know, it's a big building with a lot of storage areas that they get it out of the way. They get it out of our way so we don't see it. So that's all we care about.
But it's just so amazing to think that, like, you know, all this Price is Right stuff is going on, and it's like this madness with the lights and the sound and the screaming and the everything, and then, boom, Friday night, there's Bill Maher. Doing it on the exact same stage. Just kind of odd. Kind of like that. Anywho, it's been absolutely a delight, and I want to mention that Bob Claster was kind enough to send me another MP3 of his own music, and we're going to go out with that before we get to more B-Part.
Okay, this is a more thoughtful song.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, it's called Thinking of You.
Yeah, it's actually called Thinking of You and the Things That We Said.
And the Things That We Said.
Another, and this is another old song. I did most of my songwriting, you know, in the 70s, and I've recently sort of rediscovered my old songs, and I've decided to make good recordings of the ones that deserve it, and this is one. I'm actually assisted on this one by a spectacular young sax player named Max Kaplan.
Max Kaplan on the saxophone, Bob Claster on the telephone.
Back on sax.
I want to thank you, Bob, so much. I definitely will, you know, we'll be talking in January on this show, absolutely, because there's so much more to do. Thank you so much for being in the neighborhood. Let's hear Bob with Thinking of You and the Things That We Said.